Ladies and gentlemen, welcome to the October edition of the Freedom of Information podcast. My name is Ibrahim Hassan. You're listening to the second of a monthly podcast program designed to bring busy practitioners up to date with the latest developments in freedom of information law. In this issue, I shall be examining the implications of the government's proposal to change the FOI fees regulations, the Information Commissioner's Freedom of Information Progress Report, the vexed question of access to information about dead people, whether details of a compromise agreement are disclosable, and a number of other decisions from the Commissioner's Office and also the Information Tribunal. Let's begin by looking at the government's recently announced proposals to change the Freedom of Information charging regime. Freedom of Information requests are normally answered free of charge, but government departments can reject requests if they cost more than £600. For local authorities and other public authorities, this limit is set at £450. At the moment, in deciding whether this limit has been reached, authorities can take account of the cost of finding, retrieving and extracting the information. Under the new proposals, the public authorities would be able to include reading time, consideration time and consultation time when calculating this cost. This could mean that the cost limit is reached much more quickly, thereby allowing authorities to refuse more requests on cost grounds. The government also proposes to change the aggregation rules, which currently allow the costs of several requests to be combined when considering whether the cost limit has been reached. At present, these rules apply to two or more requests received from the same person or different people acting in concert or in pursuance of a campaign. In future, all requests made by the same individual or organisation to one authority could be lumped together and refused if the combined cost exceeds the £600 or £450 limit. This could mean that one journalist from one newspaper asking a complex question could hit the limit and thereby prevent other journalists from the same newspaper making Freedom of Information requests for at least 3 months. The government's proposals were based on a report from the Frontier Economics Group and were published in a response to the Constitutional Affairs Select Committee report into the workings of Freedom of Information. All the relevant documents are available on the DCA website, which is www.foi.gov.uk. Joining me now on the line is Maurice Frankel, Director of the Campaign for Freedom of Information. Maurice, thank you for your time. What are your thoughts about these new proposals?
Well, we're very unhappy about them. Their aim seems to be to make a substantial cut in the number of complex requests that public authorities have to deal with. There's no discussion of what these complex requests actually involve in terms of the subject matter and the type of information released. We're simply told these tend to cost more than the average. Therefore, the government thinks it's a good need to get rid of them.
The impact of changes to the aggregation rules will clearly hit journalists the most, Maurice, since they're the biggest users of freedom of information. This may well result, in my view, in public authorities focusing resources more to dealing with Joe Public's requests properly and more quickly. Surely you'd agree that this is a good thing?
Well, we hope Joe Public's requests are going to be dealt with properly under the existing rules, but the fact is that the press is the means by which the public generally find out about what the public authorities are doing. And if we exclude them, then the public is going to get much less information about what public authorities are doing, where they're doing things wrong, where they're not delivering what they promised to deliver. And instead, we're going to get a lot of people getting information about where, a private matter affecting them a little bit more quickly. I don't think that's a good trade-off at all.
Finally, Maurice, the government and even some Freedom of Information practitioners seem convinced that change is needed. What would persuade the Campaign for Freedom of Information?
I think the government has to make the case for that some changes are needed. For example, they've said in the economic assessment that's been published alongside the proposals that 5% of requests take up 45% of officials' time. Now, if that's the case, it would be very important to see the data behind that. But there may be a case for doing something about such very, very time-consuming requests, if they are. But what we've got is a proposal to knock out 13% of all requests being made. So So it seems to be going far beyond the small number of very time consuming requests that the government's data suggests are the main problem. And I think we need to know what's the effect of these restrictions on the health of the Freedom of Information Act, because some of these requests may be very, very important for the public to know about, and simply knocking off the top level of requests without attempting to discover what the effect of that will be is a very damaging thing to do.
Maurice Frankel, thank you very much for joining us. More details about the campaign's work can be found on their website at www.cfoi.org.uk. The Information Commissioner recently published a new report on the progress made by his office in carrying out its duties under the Freedom of Information Act. Since the Act came into force, the Commissioner has received over 4,400 complaints. It's now closed 72% of these cases, and an average of 245 cases are now closed each month. The number of backlog cases is expected to go down to 450 by the end of the financial year. This will clearly be good news to public authorities, but also to claimants who, in some cases, have been waiting over 16 months for a decision from the Information Commissioner. The report also includes the Information Commissioner's new enforcement strategy, which sets out a tougher approach from now on. The report and enforcement strategy are available on the Commissioner's website. This month, only one decision has been published by the Information Tribunal. Before we discuss it, I want to mention a tribunal decision which was published towards the end of last month and which contains some useful learning points. Brobrick and the Information Commissioner and Nottingham City Council was decided on the 28th of September 2006. This is an important decision for a number of reasons. Firstly, the tribunal considers the issue of whether a public authority can raise new exemptions before the Commissioner and the tribunal, which are being claimed for the first time. It states clearly that this can be done, and both the Commissioner and the Tribunal have a duty to consider these exemptions before reaching their decision. However, neither body has a positive duty to look for new exemptions that might have been claimed by the public authority, even though they have not been raised. Secondly, the Tribunal was quite scathing in its criticism of Nottingham Council, and also of individual named officers, in terms of the way the request had been handled and their conduct during the appeal before the Tribunal. It goes as far as to award costs against the Council and also to recommend to the Commissioner that he makes a practice recommendation to the Council specifying what steps it should take to comply with the codes of practice under the Act. This decision will be worrying for Freedom of Information officers who have to deal with difficult issues of fact and law. The last thing they want is the added pressure of being named in a tribunal decision. The most recent tribunal decision is Hogan and Oxford City Council and the Information Commissioner. This is dated the 17th of October 2006. The tribunal agreed with the Information Commissioner when it ruled that the disclosure of VIN numbers of vehicles owned by the council would be likely to prejudice the prevention and detection of crime and would not be in the public interest to disclose under Section 35 of the Act. The decision contains some useful guidance about the prejudice test. It also makes a useful point at paragraph 32, which I quote, "Whilst the intended use or motive of the applicant is not relevant to a decision to grant or refuse access, this tribunal accepts that where a public authority is aware of the intended use, it may be a factor for consideration when assessing the nature of the prejudice." Let's move on to recent decisions made by the Information Commissioner. There have been 22 decisions this month, and once again, they're dominated by discussion of application of the Section 40 exemption for personal data. It's now settled law that purely private information about individuals will be exempt from access. To reinforce this point, this month the Commissioner upheld one of his own decisions to refuse access to residential addresses of all his current salaried staff. But what about other personal information? We discussed a number of relevant decisions in last month's podcast. A more recent decision in this area involved City and County of Swansea and was published on the 2nd of October 2006. The council refused to disclose the cash payoff figure, which was part of a compromise agreement for Vivian Sugar, a former chief executive who retired in 2002. This was on the basis that the withheld information was personal data, and so to disclose it would be a breach of the Data Protection Act and therefore exempt under Section 40 of the Freedom of Information Act. The Commissioner agreed with this approach. he took account of the fact that Mrs. Sugar had entered into a compromise agreement which contained a confidentiality clause. Joining me now is Ilias Bulbulia, an expert on employment law and principal of IBA solicitors, to discuss this decision. Ilias, thank you very much for your time. What's your view on this decision?
I've considered the Information Commissioner's decision in detail, and I agree with what you've just said, that he seems to have relied on the confidentiality provisions of the agreement as a bar to disclosure. Now, Ibrahim, I fully accept what the Information Commissioner says at paragraph 24, that compromise agreements play a vital role. I accept they are a vital tool in resolving disputes between employers and employees. And it may well be the case that had it not been for compromise agreements, you'd find many more of these kind of disputes ending up before the tribunal. What I have slight difficulty with is that, in my experience, as far as the confidentiality clause is concerned, normally what you tend to find is that it's the employer who's requesting that there should be such a clause in the compromise agreement. See, it's rare for employees to insist on a confidentiality clause to be included in a compromise agreement. I mean, in terms of percentages, I suspect it's only in 5 or 10% of cases that you're going to find that an employee wants the inclusion of such a clause. What you've got to think about, it's the employer who doesn't want this information to become public. It doesn't want other employees to know how much has been paid out, and that's really what's behind that's really the purpose behind a confidentiality clause in a compromise agreement. Unfortunately, I think where we end up is the ability of a public sector organisation to hide behind the terms of a confidentiality clause in order to prevent disclosure. And really, my view is that that kind of situation isn't acceptable.
Ilias Bulbulia, once again, thank you. You can find more details about Ilias and his employment law expertise at www.ibasolicitors.com. Travelling around the country, I get a lot of questions about access to information about dead people. A recent Information Commissioner's decision sheds light on this difficult issue. The decision in Epsom and St Helier University Hospitals NHS Trust, dated the 25th of October 2006, concerned a request for the medical records of an individual now deceased. The request was refused under Section 41 of the Act on the grounds that an actionable duty of confidence was owed to the deceased. The Information Commissioner agreed with this approach, stating that the duty of confidentiality extends beyond death. If the information was disclosed, there is, in theory at least, an actionable breach of confidence which would allow the personal representatives of the deceased to sue the trust. This decision will assist healthcare and social services professionals who often have to consider access to such information and have to balance the competing interests of the public, relatives, and also the deceased. Finally, a decision involving a request for information about Princess Margaret. In the Commissioner's decision involving the National Archives dated 17th of October 2006, the complainant made a request for any information held by the National Archives in relation to Princess Margaret's affair and also any illegitimate children born to her during certain dates. He subsequently made 637 requests for individual closed documents in the National Archives online catalogue. The Commissioner considered representations from both parties and decided that the National Archives had applied Section 12 and Section 14 of the Act correctly, in that to comply with the requests they would exceed the cost limit, and also the requests were repeated requests. This is an interesting decision because of the story in the Times on the 25th of October 2006 about a solicitor who is taking High Court action to get the wills of Princess Margaret and her mother open to public scrutiny. He claims that he is her illegitimate son and so 12th in line to the throne. That's all the decisions we have time for this month. Don't forget, Act Now Training is running a major conference on freedom of information where these decisions and other freedom of information issues will be discussed in detail. Maurice Frankel, as well as the Assistant Information Commissioner Gerard Tracy, are amongst the speakers. Act Now also runs workshops on data protection, surveillance law and records management. Full details can be found at www.actnow.com. freedomofinformationnow.org.uk. That concludes this month's podcast. This podcast was brought to you by me, Ibrahim Hassan. I specialise in training and advice on all aspects of freedom of information law, as well as data protection and surveillance law. My clients include local authorities, the NHS, and government agencies. If you would like any specific advice or training on any of these aspects, please don't hesitate to contact me either through my website, www.informationlaw.org.uk, or by sending me an email at ih@informationlaw.org.uk. Please continue to let me have your feedback about this podcast. This is the only podcast of its kind in the UK. I've already had 800 downloads to last month's programme. The script for that programme is now available to download from the website. If you'd like a copy of this month's script, please contact me via the website www.informationlaw.org.uk. Thank you for listening, and until the next time, goodbye.